Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Adam Kadlec. He is teaching professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University, where he is also involved in the Disability Studies Initiative. We're talking about his new book, The Magic Kingdom and the Meaning of Life, A Philosopher Visits Disney World. Adam, welcome to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
It's really great to talk to about it with you.
I'm going to have a confession to you. I had no idea what this book was about, where it was going to go. I saw it advertised, I think, in the New York Review of Books, and it looked so intriguing that I got it. And then I fully admit it was really thought-provoking, made me think. I found this a really fascinating book that didn't go places where I thought it was going to go.
Well, can I confess that when I was writing it, I actually sort of had that kind of reaction in mind from people who are like, what is this, you know, book by a philosopher about Disney World? what could he possibly have to say? And maybe sort of falling into it and discovering that, yeah, it maybe leads into some places that they hadn't thought about. So I'm pleased to hear that reaction. That was, like I say, sort of one of the things I was thinking about in the back of my head as I was writing it.
Well, it also got me to thinking that maybe we should be sending philosophers to other situations like Disney World and just like have them like make note of what they're feeling, what they're thinking, and so on and so forth. That would be sort of an interesting idea.
Yeah, well, I think there has been maybe an increase over the last 20 years in philosophers writing about popular culture. It's pretty uneven in my view in terms of how good it is. Some of it's very good, some of it's not as good, but I do think that if we have our kind of philosophical radar up, as I sort of describe it to my students, that there's a lot going on in the world that we have something maybe interesting to say about or can at least put in a different perspective. It was kind of the approach I took with my first book on sports fandom. It was a same sort of thing where I was kind of trying to understand my own relationship to this thing that had become a big part of my life. And you kind of push a little deeper and put it under the philosophical microscope and see what you find. And that definitely turned out to be the pattern with the Disney project.
Now, confession, I've never visited Disney World or Disneyland. I have four older grandchildren. They're in college or out of college. Never gone. And I have to admit, my attitude until your book was very much like what you discuss in the chapter, the hipster fallacy.
And yeah.
What was really shocking to me was sort of to find some part of how I thought about Disneyland in that chapter.
Yeah, I think I probably – so I wasn't a Disney kid in a real intense way growing up. I mentioned in the book that we had extended family in Florida, and so we went a few times when I was growing up. And it was always a fun experience, but not a huge kind of part of my life. And then a real gap until I think we took our first trip with my wife and kids in 2015. My wife was the one kind of nudging us to go, like, hey, she had been at home with our daughter for a few years, and she was like, if I'm going back to work, we're going to Disney World. And I said, that's fine. That's a fair trade-off. So I probably had a similar – I wasn't super enthusiastic. I was willing. I wasn't you know, dreading going, but I probably had a similar kind of view that this is, you know, big, commercial,
right,
super popular,
right,
super crowded. But then we went, and after that first trip we went, I was like, well, I mean, we could go back next year. So it was me at that point. I was kind of the convert. And I think, you know, I probably couldn't have articulated at that point, but over the years, my thought that we can have intimate relationships, personal connections to things that are really popular kind of took shape. You know, we have those connections in other areas of life too. I mean, I'm fans of really popular sports teams, but I still feel like I have a personal connection to those teams. You know, popular bands, popular films.
Oh, yeah. That hipster fallacy thing is especially true for alternative music.
Where people think that...
Well, as soon as the band becomes popular, I no longer like it.
Oh, yeah, of course. There's actually a class that someone teaches here at Wake Forest called I think it's called I Liked That Band Before They Were Popular.
Right.
It's basically about hipster culture. And I fully admit I have that tendency sometimes too. Like, oh, a lot of people like this thing. It can't be as good as everybody says it is.
Right.
And in that chapter, I try to kind of philosophically explore, well, what might be going on here? What might the impulse be to think that this thing that everybody's super enthusiastic about actually isn't that good?
Well, I also want to mention that this is also a book about family and how we think about family, how we feel about family. And that took me by surprise, too.
It's definitely the most personal thing I've ever written.
I can imagine. Yeah.
You know, trying to iron out what to talk about, you know, respect the families, you know. It's my book. It's not their book. Definitely didn't write anything that I wouldn't say in their presence. So they're all sort of in on the project. But because my connection to Disney World ended up being so much about family experiences and family connections and shared experiences, you know, I talk in the first chapter, I have an intellectually disabled daughter. And so our experience at the park is really filtered through that connection.
And that writing was surprising to me, because one of the things you write about is how sensitive the staff was to your daughter's situation.
They are. They've been, over the years, they've been great. We were actually just there this past spring break a couple weeks ago. And, you know, again, they're great in sort of handling her particular challenges. It was really important those first couple years because she was so much younger, and navigating that what could be even a little bit more overwhelming. The challenges and the way we engage with the park has evolved over the years as she's gotten older. She's 18 now, and so she's, you know, I kind of commented to some people that this was the first time we've gone where it really felt like we were navigating the park with an intellectually disabled adult rather than an intellectually disabled child. And that sort of changed some things in interesting ways that we're, you know, probably still grappling with and thinking about. But the staff has always been excellent and accommodating and helping her have the best experience possible, and therefore helping us as a family have the best experience we can have, yeah.
You begin the book by describing exactly the conditions that made me vow to never visit Disneyland in the first place. And we're talking about lines and crowds in the heat. There is no good way. There's no way to make that a great experience.
It's not. I mean, as you say, I begin the book with this anecdote that really is kind of the origin story of the book, of us standing in line at Epcot for I don't know how long it was that day, as the park was getting ready to open, and it was hot, and we were just baking in the sun, and I thought, wow, this is really silly. What are we doing here? And, you know, I'm not sure that I have a chapter on standing in line where I argue that there are virtues and benefits to standing in line because it forces us to stop and wait. They allow us to look forward to things rather than experiencing them instantaneously. I certainly wouldn't contend, and I compare that experience of standing in line at Disney World to other line standing experiences we have in life, and I certainly would not argue that all line standing can be redeemed. And I wouldn't even argue that all line standing at Disney can be redeemed. But it did make me think about, well, would the experience have been better if we would have just had instant gratification throughout the day?
This is what makes your book great.
And I'm not sure it would have. And we had some line standing experiences this last trip that weren't, you know, the most pleasant, most exciting, but at the risk of sort of trying to live out my own theory, I did try to think about, all right, no, we're stopping, we're chatting. This is a chance to pause and think about, you know, what we've done already, debrief, what's coming next, and just take a minute rather than constantly moving around to every experience kind of in a frazzled, frantic way.
One of the things about standing in a Disneyland like that is you're also watching a lot of other families, some of whom were having meltdowns.
Yes.
And that's sobering and annoying.
My perception of all that has changed over the years too. Again, maybe just because I worked on the book. This time I had my radar up for all the things I talked about in the book when we were just there a couple weeks ago, to sort of as a test case. It was our first trip to Disney World since The book had come out, and so I was kind of like, all right, how does all this hold up? And the meltdowns stood out in ways that maybe they hadn't before, because I was like, okay, how many meltdowns are there really? And there are a lot of particularly young kids kind of melting down.
Yeah.
But what I noticed this time was really interesting was that other parents in the vicinity tended to look with just sympathy at other parents. Like, because we've all been there. If you've been out at any long, it doesn't have to be Disney World, any long excursion, any day-long event with small kids, they're going to break down at some point. And it was really noticeable to me this time where there's, you know, sympathy and compassion for people going through those circumstances. And I actually thought this time, again, this is all anecdotal, but it felt like the parents this time were a lot calmer than in trips in the past. Huh. Like, it was something that they had come to expect. They knew it was coming. I didn't see parents, you know, berating their kids maybe sometimes like I had in the past. It was just sort of calmly trying to take them aside and say, all right, let's gather ourselves. You probably need something to eat. And we'll move to the next thing.
It really has to test your mettle, these incredible lines at Disney, though. There really has to be a parent's serious test of, you're out in the heat and the humidity. You have young children who are not the most patient people in the world. And you're standing there, and obviously, you're right, there's going to be meltdowns. And
And I think you have to prepare.
Over time,
you know, all right. And with our daughter in particular, who doesn't have meltdowns in the same way that a young child has meltdowns, but she definitely, there were two periods this last time where she decided that she was done with the day and she wanted to go back to the hotel. And that just wasn't an option. Like, that's not what we were going to do. So we just had to kind of, and we knew that something like that was probably coming. And so we kind of prepared for, how are we going to handle this? And one time I just took her and walked along by myself with her while my wife went and poked around in some shops while Sadie calmed down. And then the other time it was very clear that Sadie was just hungry, so she needed something to eat. So, you know, you plan for those contingencies, and I think experience, this is the one benefit of being a multi-time visitor to the parks, is that you know what works and you know what you can prepare for, so how to navigate those almost inevitable experiences. There's also all the tools that Disney has now to sort of avoid standing in long lines all the time. So there's various...
And you write about that in the book, especially for parents of children with special needs. There's all sorts of interesting things that you can opt out for, and that'll make it go. And people can read the book to know that. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Adam Cadlak. He is teaching professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University, where he's also involved in the Disability Studies Initiative. And we're talking about his new book. It's surprising. It was a great read. The Magic Kingdom and the Meaning of Life. A Philosopher Visits Disney World. Now, Adam, I've actually experienced this. We're going to talk about princesses.
Yeah.
When my eldest granddaughter was very young, we had agreed, as her grandparents, to take her to an event that was a Disney event. And so we went to pick her up at her house. I was unprepared for the fact that she would be in full princess regalia, and it actually shocked me. But when you go to Disney, that's a huge piece of it. So how do you think about it? I mean, we're talking about royalty, we're talking about questions about feminism and feminist criticisms of this. How do you make sense of this?
Well, it is. First of all, the kids walking around in their costumes are adorable, though you wonder how hot they are in some of the full princess regalia.
It was weird sitting in a huge auditorium. I was sitting in a huge auditorium with all these princesses. It was like surreal.
Yeah. I mean, I talk about in the chapter that I wrestled with this. It was early on, it was notable the way in which the Disney staff greeted our daughter as a princess when she was getting on attractions. And I was like, this bugs me for some reason. I don't really like it because I don't like like all you said, the royalty and the kind of anti-feminist connotations that the idea that everyone wants to be a princess might have. And so I wrestled with that for a couple years, actually, just thinking about, like, why does this bother me? They're being nice to her. They're honoring her. They're treating her in a fun, inclusive way. So why does this bother me? And it kind of got me to dive into the princess movies a little bit more than I had in the past, and to think about, well, what's going on with the princess movies? Like, why does the princess trope have this kind of power? And it's a mixed bag. I'm not going to try to say that it's always great. But one of the things that it sort of stood out to me, particularly in the later princess movies, is that they're girls and women who just happen to be princesses and don't really, in some ways, like being princesses. That comes with a whole bunch of expectation. And what they really want is to be seen as individuals. So,
right,
you know,
right.
You have the Frozen movies and Tangled, and even, you know, Moana is a princess, and all these girls and women are wanting to be their own self and live their own life. And that actually struck me as a kind of powerful parallel with my daughter, who, you know, the world sees in various ways because of her disability. And what I want for her actually is just to be seen as an individual. And that kind of connection is something that actually being at Disney World got me to think about and explore in a way that I definitely don't think I would have otherwise.
I found it a really interesting chapter, because you talk about, you know, people want to feel special, but at the same point, they want to seem quote-unquote normal. So there seems like that there's that tension between those two things.
For sure. And I had taught that the work on the desire to be normal by Ava Katte that I talk about in the book is a paper I've taught in class for years, even before I started working on this project. And so that idea that there's the desire to be normal might seem like it's a desire just to be like everybody else, but there's a way in which a desire to be normal is a desire to be in a space where people can see you just as an individual, because they're not blocking you out by, you know, some perceived abnormality that you have, or they're not marginalizing you as weird. And so that kind of argument had been in the back of my head rolling around because I'd been teaching it for a number of years. And then the connection between that desire and what a lot of the Disney princesses actually are experiencing. You know, they don't want the trappings. They don't want the constraints. They just want to be normal. They just want to be like everybody else in a lot of ways. And that connection struck me as interesting and pretty compelling.
In that, you quote Ava Katte in the book talking about the positive and negative sides of being quote-unquote normal, having to admit to a certain banality. Just say you're normal, like you're one of the folks, it becomes I'm just not special. I don't want to use special. I want to use unique, I think is different.
Yeah. The special, the editors, so that piece was published elsewhere. People can actually find it. If you Google my name and princesses, this article that came out in the Raven will come up. It's made its way into the book as chapter one, but the special language was suggested by the editors of the Raven, and I think it works for what I'm trying to argue there. But I think, yeah, unique or individual or not average. I mean, there's the way in which, you know, the desire to be normal can be the desire to be average. But you know, I talk to my students about this, and I ask them, well, do you want to be normal? And when you frame it as, do I want to be average? There's no Wake Forest student that wants to be average.
Yeah, nobody does. Nobody does. Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But when you're like, well, do you want to be weird? Do you want to be quirky even? A lot of Wake Forest students don't want to be weird or quirky. They want to be in the group. But I think the impulse to want to be in the group, to be seen as just like everybody else, again, has this sense of they want to be seen like everybody else so that they can be seen for who they really are.
I think it was really interesting. I mean, through the eyes of Sadie and Sadie's experiences for you, though, you were really able to go deep on this idea.
Yeah, and I've plumbed or sort of wrestled both as a parent and as a philosopher with a lot of these challenges over the years. And, you know, I try not to use her as a philosophical thought experiment.
I understand that.
which I don't, I work really hard to, you know, not do that. But at the same time, wrestle with, you know, the challenges we have as parents. I'm a philosopher too. I don't really ever take that hat off. So trying to understand how all this works and how I might think about it and what the norms are around these relationships is something that I never really set aside. So it was, you know, a chance to think about these issues as a philosopher, philosopher father, you know, not taking either of those labels off.
In the chapter, Why Are People So Grumpy? I love the title. You talk about the emotional tension that lays just below the surface. And we talked about this a little bit earlier in the interview. And the paradox of hedonism. Can you talk about what that is?
Yeah, so philosophers and psychologists have kind of noted that oftentimes the best way to be happy, just think about happiness in general, that the best way to be happy is not to try to be happy. That if you try explicitly, if you have happiness as your aim, it's not really a good recipe for actually being happy. In fact, what sort of produces real happiness or pleasure in more sort of local circumstances is that if you work to immerse yourself in an activity that you find worthwhile or that you enjoy, and there's a way in which you can kind of forget yourself and happiness kind of comes as a byproduct. John Stuart Mill talks about this in some passages that I quote in the book. And again, something I've talked about in classes and thought about and known over the years, but that as the book began to take shape in my head, struck me as definitely applying to the experiences that people have at somewhere like Disney World. I mean, this, you know, other experiences can fill in this role as well. But anytime you build something up as going to be the most amazing thing that has ever happened, a lot of families build these trips up to be, you know, this is going to be the most amazing vacation you've ever had. And so they're trying to have the most amazing vacation they've ever had. And that puts a lot of pressure on the experience. It also makes you more attentive to what's going on in you, in your own psychology, in your own feelings, as opposed to being attentive to the, you know, the relationships and the environment and the experience. And I think that latter bit is a better recipe for actually enjoying yourself rather than worrying about making sure you have the best time possible. And that's definitely a lesson I've tried to internalize. It is tough. And especially, you know, the money that people spend and the time, and your kids are in a window where you're like, well, we may never get to do this again.
And I know.
We need to have all these amazing memories, all of which are perfectly, in my view, perfectly legitimate, like, desires. There's nothing wrong with that desire. It's when you layer the pressure to make it all deliver on top, I think, that people can sometimes get into trouble.
There's a good quote that I think it was on page 42. I think people tend to assume that there is something deficient about an experience if it does not deliver an uninterrupted stream of enjoyment.
Yeah.
And that is so true.
Yeah, I mean.
And then they react negatively when they're not enjoying themselves every second.
Yeah, that's right. I actually think that I'm talking about similar themes in my intro level class this week, not in context of Disney, but just in life. this sense that we often have in life that there's something wrong with us if we're not enjoying every single thing that we're doing throughout the day. And when you put that, you know, the added pressure of an experience like Disney World on, you know, on top of that, that can increase that pressure. I mean, I think that's a pressure that a lot of us experience anyway, a sense that we have that, well, this is kind of, you know, I don't really enjoy cleaning toilets or changing diapers.
Right.
And so, you know, maybe there's something wrong with me. This is what I'm supposed to want in life. I've got everything I've ever wanted. Why am I not enjoying this? Well, it's because there's nothing particularly enjoyable about cleaning toilets or changing diapers. And in life, that's one thing. But actually, there's some things about even the most enjoyable experiences we can have, like at Disney World, that are just kind of mundane. I mean, you know, there's a lot of just normal stuff that happens throughout a day. And if you worry, oh, am I enjoying every second of this to the absolute maximum extent possible, that worry can create anxiety. Whereas if you just take each day as it comes, I think, and it's hard. I mean, I'm not suggesting it's easy to fall into the same trap as everybody else. But if you can just take each day as it comes and focus on the people around you and the cool things that are happening and kind of lose yourself in a way, I think that's a better recipe for enjoying yourself.
You also write about, you know, you can get out of yourself and the need that you have and help facilitate happiness in others. And that sort of seems like a more mature attitude.
Well, that's definitely true. I mean, I try... I mean, maybe this is the stereotypical middle-aged dad. I kind of take on the role of I make sure all the plans are in order. I kind of run these trips in terms of what our agenda is going to be. A role, by the way, that my wife is perfectly happy to handle hand over to me. But I do. I mean, I kind of think about, all right, well, when my son's in college now, so he wasn't on our most recent trip, but when he's been on our trips in the past. You know, making sure that, well, what do you want to do? Because what he wants to ride and what he might want to see is probably not going to be the same thing as, you know,
right.
what my daughter wants
right.
to do and ride and see. And so kind of being attentive to, well, what's their experience like? Are they having a good time?
We're also a way
to enjoy myself.
We're also completely out of time, unfortunately. My guest tonight has been Adam Cadillac. He is teaching professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University, where he's also involved in the Disability Studies Initiative. And we've been talking about his new book. It really is a great read. The Magic Kingdom and the Meaning of Life, A Philosopher Visits Disney World. Adam, it's been a real pleasure.
Pleasure's been all mine. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.